This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Professor Salim Rashid, who is professor of economics at the University of Illinois, and we're going to be talking about the Islamic understanding of the economy. Now, you yourself are a Muslim.
Yes.
And in Muslim tradition, going back to the Quran, there are actual teachings or I'm not sure how to say it. I guess there are commandments almost about how Muslims are to function in the economic system. Is that correct?
Yes, there are general injunctions for the most part, what you would call moral precepts that are frequently repeated. But the presumption that we are dealing with a private enterprise economy is always behind all those injunctions.
Hmm.
So there was a phase in the 50s and 60s when something called Islamic socialism was very popular. But I think that was more a response to the Cold War and to an attempt to kind of balance bridges between the two camps in the Cold War than a view of Islam that had solid foundations.
And so when you talk about the private economy, are you talking about laissez-faire capitalism? What are you talking about?
We're talking about a system which I think, if I may steal a modern phrase and give it an anachronistic use, about welfare capitalism, in the sense that the dominant form of economic activity in the state is to be undertaken by individuals privately for the sake of profit. However, the state is set over and above these individuals with the goal of regulating their transactions so as to prohibit such obvious ills as can come about through monopolies, to regulate in various practices in the market, such as adulterated goods, and to see to it that those who, in essence, have bad luck in the economy nonetheless get looked after.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that underpinning of welfare or a caring or a sharing system that provides sustenance to everybody.
And so that would be true for Muslims anywhere around the world in many different countries, that would be the injunction that they, if they were involved in establishing a government or voting or whatever, those would be some of the concerns that from the Muslim faith should be evidenced. There should be a concern for the common good, for welfare of everybody, even if they don't make it in the economic system of that country.
Absolutely. And even though there are several schools of thought about what actually constitutes Islamic economics, as the phrase goes, I think everybody is in agreement that social justice is an important ingredient of the Islamic economic system. And this is an injunction which is repeated very often in the Quran also. I do not believe there is much dispute on this issue, that no matter whether you consider private property to be predominant or whether you consider it to be only, so to speak, a part of the economy, that social justice is a necessary part of the economic system is definitely widely accepted.
Okay. And to jump just quickly into one of the surprising things for many people from a Jewish or Christian or Hindu background about Islam in terms of economics, there are prohibitions against usury, against charging interest in the Quran for Muslims. Tell us about that.
Well, let me first point out that this should not be a surprise to anyone from a biblical background. because usury is prohibited both to the Jews, and historically it was very vigorously prohibited by the church for many centuries. And the modern viewpoint only came into being about the time of Calvin.
Really?
When Calvin said that usury can be permitted, and he added the significant phrase, provided it be not biting.
Ah.
And that left it to the judgment of the individual as to when the usury was biting. Luther, to my knowledge, did not permit usury. So this is the movement itself began with the Reformation, but has become, so to speak, widely accepted only in the 20th century. Right into the 18th and 19th centuries, both England and the United States did have usury laws. And they may even still be some on the books, even though we don't hear about them.
We certainly don't hear about them. So the practice of allowing, for example, Christians to charge interest to one another when they made loans to one another came with the Protestant Reformation, or at least one wing of the Protestant
Reformation. Legalized with that. I'm sure merchants took the equivalent of interest for centuries.
Uh-huh.
But they had means to either disguise it or they simply hid the transaction.
I see.
But I think the legalization of interest occurred only after the Reformation. And in fact, the scholars who have studied the wills of merchants in the Catholic ages say that frequently on their deathbed, many merchants made restitution because of the usury they would have taken.
That it had been wrong to do
that. That's right, it had been wrong. It was, in fact, a prohibition that was certainly, it carried some pinch on the conscience in those days.
And since in the United States this notion would still be, and perhaps Western Europe too, this notion would still be a surprise to many Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, that was part of their tradition, that forbidding of charging interest. What was it based on then for Christians, and you say for Jews as well?
Certainly.
And today for Muslims, what is the idea behind that being wrong?
Well, I think there is again a dispute on this in the Christian literature, because modern scholars think that people actually made the transition from using an earlier framework to using a Hellenic framework. And since Aristotle had prohibited interest, in effect, the early Christian church adopted some Hellenic categories and thereby made it into a rigid prescription, whereas it might have been an informal guideline in the early church. Mm. Now, in the Muslim period, or for Muslims, again, the prohibition of interest is something that is partly disputed. There is a minority of people who feel that the current interpretation is much too strict.
Hmm.
But let me deal with the majority interpretation
right
now. And the majority interpretation is that interest in any form is to be prohibited. And the technical word or the Arabic word by which it is described is riba, frequently spelled as R-I-B-A, is riba. And I believe the literal meaning of which is to increase. And the idea then is that increase in the form of interest is prohibited.
Hmm.
Now, in order to explain this further, I think I would have to both talk about what function interest performs in the economy and why these functions can still be conducted in an Islamic economy without the formal taking of interest, so to speak.
Let's get into that. But before we do, let me just reintroduce our guest today on Keeping the Faith. We're speaking about the Islamic understanding of the economy with Professor Salim Rashid, who's been a professor here at the University of Illinois for many years. He first came here, 23 years ago, you were telling
1981.
Me? 1981. Uh-huh. And you came here first as probably an assistant?
As an associate professor.
Associate professor. And where did you come from?
I was teaching at Dartmouth College at that time.
Where had you studied?
At Yale.
Your PhD?
Yes.
And before that?
At the London School of Economics.
And what degree was that?
I did a bachelor's. It's called BSc Econ with special subject statistics.
Yes, of course, English system. That's right. and you came originally to England from where?
From what was then Pakistan and subsequently became Bangladesh.
I see.
So I'm a Bangladeshi American, an expatriate.
Hmm. And you've been in this country. You came to Dartmouth when?
I came to Yale in 1970, and I've been in the United States more or less ever since.
And you have family here?
Yes, I do. I have my wife, and we have four children.
Four. Still have family in Bangladesh?
I do. My two older brothers are there.
Very good.
So they are my only siblings.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to these topics we were just starting to get into. But let me encourage listeners, if you have a question for our guest today, please give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, you may punch in 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. In Champaign-Urbana, you can reach the same studio by using a local number, 333-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Well, let's explore this notion of what function interest plays in the economy.
Well, the way economists think about it is as follows, that when you transfer money from someone who has an excess at the moment to someone who is in a deficit position, so the creditor and the debtor, the creditor has some purchasing power which they don't wish to use now but use later. And the person who is borrowing money needs the purchasing power now but intends to pay it back later. So what we're really doing is we are transferring the purchasing power over time. We're taking one person's purchasing power and adding to it right now if I borrow money. And I'm transferring this purchasing power to the creditor later on. Just as we would charge a fee for transporting an apple from Indianapolis to Champaign, so too we charge a fee for transporting this purchasing power over time. And that is what interest does. It is the price of transporting money over time. So given that that is the function that interest performs in the economy, how does the Islamic system function? Well, the price of time per se, the fact that time might have a value, is permitted in Islam. So, for example, you can't walk to a Muslim merchant and say, will you sell me a bag of rice, which he would, of course, do if he has it. And then you ask him how much, and he says $10, and you tell him, well, I'll pay you next year because you can't take interest, so I'll just charge. No, that would not be right. No one is obligated to that. Time can have a value. Mm-hmm. What you cannot have is what we call the equivalent of a bank interest, where you are guaranteed a return on your money without doing anything. That is what is not permitted. So let me wait and see if you have any questions now before I go on from there.
All right. Well, let me just ask a couple of very simple-minded questions because my training was in theology, not economics. I've never taken a course in economics, unfortunately. But perhaps there are listeners in my situation. So let me ask a couple questions. So are Muslims prohibited only from charging interest, but they may receive interest if they have money in a bank that pays them interest?
No, both are prohibited.
Ah.
The idea is that, let's just talk first about what the banking system does. We go and give money in the bank and say the bank offers us 1% interest. Well, where does the bank have the ability to pay us this 1% interest? The bank then loans that money out to other businessmen, and those businessmen pay the bank, let's say, 3 or 4% interest.
Sure.
Because they are undertaking a profit-making entrepreneurial activity. And the bank survives on the difference between what it pays us and what the businessmen pay it.
Not only survives, often does very
well. Very well, yes. Yeah. True. Now, the point that is of significance from the Islamic point of view is that the individual who is giving money to the bank receives a return without ever participating in the risk that that businessman is incurring when he starts a business. The Islamic point of view is that it's fine to get a profit, but you must share in the risk. You should not have the ability to make money, so to speak, in your sleep. You can make as much money as you want, but if you do it in a business venture, it has to be with a shared risk. So that Islam encourages the equivalent of banking, but with a profit-sharing system. So when you go and put money in the bank, you will not be guaranteed a return. What the bank will say is one of two things. If you want it invested in a particular type of business, we will do that for you. And this will be our share of the profit. This will be your share of the profit. The other option is that the bank might tell you that, look, you give us the money, we will diversify this money in so many different types of businesses that for all practical purposes, you may be guaranteed a return. Because if one market fails, the other market will do well. So the idea then is that if you diversify it, there is some bottom level of interest that you can practically always hope to get. But the Islamic banking system, or the Islamic system, economic system, as it is currently spoken of, wants to enforce the idea that people participate actively in the use of their money and not just passively.
So in Muslim countries where this Muslim economic system is practiced, the government, I take it then, does not insure investments in banks as happens in this country.
At the moment, it would be wrong for it to insure any investment in an Islamic bank. But even in all the Muslim countries that I know of, the Islamic banking is only a minor share of the entire banking system. In most Muslim countries right now, the general banking system is what you would call the Western banking system. It was begun in the colonial period, and it has continued as being the major share ever since. And what we call Islamic banking basically took off only after 1976.
Very recently.
Very recently. And in fact, say in the early days of, say, after Nasser took over Egypt, they were very suspicious of anything called Islamic explicitly. Because the first actual Islamic bank had to operate under a different name because the Egyptian authorities would not allow it to operate as an Islamic bank. It was only later that they softened up. So the actual spread of Islamic banking has been quite recent, early 80s onwards.
Let me introduce our guest again. We're talking with Professor Salim Rashid, who is a professor of economics here at the University of Illinois with training from PhD from Yale and earlier degrees from the London School of Economics, originally from Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh.
A part of it. East Pakistan is now Bangladesh.
Right. And we're eager to have people join the conversation and ask questions, make comments. The numbers are 1-800-222-9455 for people listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area. In Champaign-Urbana, where the program originates, you may call us at 333-9455. Now, Professor, and I might thank you for making a special effort to be on this program today since it's still during the feast of the fast of Ramadan, and you'll be breaking that fast after this program. And so you've gone all day without not only food but without liquids. And I know it's difficult to speak on the radio without sipping water. So thank you so much for being here, and appreciate the Imam from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, Dr. Mujahid Al-Fayyad, for arranging you to be here. But thank you very much.
Not at all. It is entirely my pleasure to be here, and I'm grateful to you for giving me this opportunity. I hope I'm not being unduly hoarse because of lack of water all day long, but I hope the listeners don't have any trouble with my voice.
Your voice is coming across just fine. Well, let's talk just a little bit, since I mentioned Ramadan. For Muslims in this country, being such a minority, is it difficult when other people don't understand what Muslims are going through with the 30-month-long fast?
I would say not generally so. I think there has probably been a lesser desire to understand Muslim practices since 9/11. But prior to that, I would always observe that people would actually ask detailed questions about the length of the fasting period, or whether we were allowed to drink water during the day or not, and how long the entire period lasted, and so on. And on the whole, I would say people were generally very receptive and appreciative.
Mm-hmm. And when you came to this country, you were first at teaching at Dartmouth, you said, and or came to Yale and then to Dartmouth and now here. Have there been strong Muslim communities in each of those places?
No, I would say the Muslim community in New Haven at Yale was virtually non-existent in my time. And of course, in Dartmouth, which has as a motto, a voice crying out in the wilderness, if you know, it is so isolated that most people say there is no community
at all.
But no, I think it would be presumptuous to think that there would be substantial Muslim community there. But I think since coming to Champaign, I think there has been a sizable community here, enough to make what we would call communal life, feasible and workable.
And you'd mentioned before we went on the air that following this program, you'll be going immediately to a family gathering with some other Bangladeshis expatriates who will be breaking the fast together.
That's right.
We have a caller to join the program on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes. You said that the banking system in most of the Muslim countries is mostly Western. But doesn't that conflict with what you said before, that it's against the Quran? So aren't these people considered, you know, in violation? Especially take the Saudis, for instance. Do they receive interest? I assume they do. It seems very hypocritical from the point of view of a true believer.
That is a good point. Let me say that I do not know categorically whether the Saudis are using Western banking or not. I do know that most of the other countries in the world, so let's say you can take 40 other Muslim countries, in practically every single one, the banking system is what you would call the banking system in America or Britain. And it is a small percentage, even Malaysia, for example, which is supposed to have the most advanced system of Islamic banking, does not have, I think, more than 10% of its banking system that is run through the Islamic banks. So the banking system per se in all these countries, again, with Saudi Arabia, let me just put a caveat, is definitely the Western banking system.
And you mentioned in terms of Malaysia, that is the country that has the largest number of Muslims anywhere in the world, and you say they have the most advanced system of Islamic banking. How did that come about?
Did you say that Malaysia has the largest number of Muslims?
I thought that was
Indonesia.
Oh, I'm sorry. It is Indonesia.
It is Indonesia, Malaysia.
How did this system grow up? You said it really just got started very, very recently.
Yes, it is. Really took roots in the late 70s. And people became much more aware, the idea that, you know, Muslims have not been conscious of what it means to be having an Islamic life until the 70s generally. Hmm. Because during the colonial period, people simply said that as long as births, marriages and deaths are conducted in the Muslim way, you're living a Muslim life. And starting in the 70s, that consciousness started changing. And people began to say, no, there must be more to it than that. And that explains, in a sense, why people were able to adopt all the colonial banking systems and never thought twice about it, so to speak. And starting in the late 70s, as that consciousness arose, many people said that maybe if this interest is prohibited, we should actually start a banking system that is not based on interest. And that's why, as I said, it's only around 1976 that the first Islamic banking became a public venture, so to speak.
Now, what about back before the Western colonial banking structure was set up, when Islam began in the 7th century and started spreading and growing? What was the view of economics for Muslims then?
There was extensive trade because Islam is very supportive of trading and production and economic activity. But it took place without the financing mechanism of what we call modern banking. So basically, savings and investments would be channeled either through friends and family or on a trust basis. And perhaps it's hard for us to visualize those days, but the surviving documents that we have show us, say, a merchant sitting in Cairo would be writing to a merchant sitting in Yemen or another merchant sitting in India. And they have never met each other all their lives, but they're carrying on a familial relationship for decades. And they begin their letters by saying, I am in your place as you are in my place. So that trust enabled them to conduct this long-distance trade and finance without what we call modern banking.
We're about halfway through our program. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the host for the program, and our guest today is Professor Salim Rashid. I'm going to let him rest his voice for just a minute or two while I let listeners know what's coming up on this program in the weeks ahead. We'll be hearing next week on the 31st of October. Our guest will be Donna Hacker-Smith, who is the chaplain at Cunningham Children's Home. And she will be talking about the Christian theology and the Harry Potter books. That's next week here on Keeping the Faith at 5 o'clock on WILL AM 580. Our guest November 7 will be Kevin Stein, who is the current State of Illinois Poet Laureate, a professor at Butler University. Professor Stein will be talking with us by phone and reading some of his poetry and talking about some of his ideas for his two-year term as the Poet Laureate for the State of Illinois. And this is kind of poetry month here on Keeping the Faith because we're very pleased on November 21st to have in our studio the current United States Poet Laureate, Ted Kooser. And he'll be reading some of his poetry on November 21st. On November 28, we have a repeat guest, Jack Good, who was on the program about a year ago, and talking about his book, The Dishonest Church. And that book has created quite a bit of interest around the country, and we're happy to have Jack Good on the program November 28, talking about the responses that have come in written form and personal form and phone calls to Dr. Good about his book, talking about the dishonest church. And he's speaking from a Protestant Christian perspective. So those are some of the programs coming up in the weeks ahead here on Keeping the Faith. And let me take just a moment, for those of you who may not be familiar with the poetry of Ted Kooser. I've previously read some some of the poetry of Kevin Stein on the air, but let me read a short poem by our current reigning poet laureate for the United States, Ted Kooser, from his most recent book that's out just this year called Delights and Shadows. Kooser, by the way, is spelled K-O-O-S-E-R. And here's a poem he has called Praying Hands, P-R-A-Y-I-N-G, hands, praying hands. There's at least one pair in every thrift shop in America, molded in plastic or plaster of Paris and glued to a plaque or printed in church pamphlet colors and framed under glass. Today, I saw a pair made out of lightweight wire, stretched over a pattern of finishing nails. This is the way faith goes from door to door, cast out of one and welcomed at another. A butterfly presses its wings like that as it rests between flowers. Praying Hands, a poem by Ted Kooser, found in his current book, Delights and Shadows, published by Copper Canyon Press this year, and read by permission of the press and the poet. And again, Ted Kooser will be our guest in the studio November 21. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the University of Illinois, founded in 1873 by students. It's also the oldest continuous student organization on campus. And since those early days, the Y has been helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for community service and social action. Some of our programs for students involve work for the environment, Students for Environmental Concerns, for example, and volunteering in the public schools, doing tutoring. Many university students get involved in that. I see we have a caller waiting, so let's go to that call. And you are on the air on line four with our guest in the studio today, Professor Salim Rashid. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. I'm calling from Chicago, and because of the time change, this will be the last program I'll be able to get in on my radio until spring.
Well, thank you for listening and calling while you can.
Thank you. And to Professor Rashid, thank you for taking this time during Ramadan to discuss the subject
My
of
pleasure.
The economy. I wanted to ask if you would comment on the work, the people-centered economy of some people like Amartya Sen, who won a Nobel Prize for a different kind of economics from what usually goes, what the prize usually goes to. And would you comment on any other economists whose work you find interesting and recommend some reading, finally, that people who don't know about Islam could learn from in regard to the economy and ordinary daily life? Thank you very much. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you for the call.
Well, thank you for your questions. They're actually quite comprehensive. And let me start by referring to the first point about Amartya Sen, an economist whom I admire greatly because he has, in effect, protested all of his career about the idea that economics should be only about increasing the GDP and in insisting that equity and deprivation should be primary concerns for those who wish to be policy economists at any rate. And he has also tried to develop the notion that it is human potential that we should all try and maximize and not some abstract concept of monetary values. However, these ideas are still in the process of being developed. They haven't been effectuated yet. So I will simply express my admiration at the moment and say that the work is ongoing in Amartya Sen's prolific career as an economist.
And the other question the caller had was about some books that you might recommend.
There is actually a very extensive bibliography, which is not what I think you, the answer you wanted. You're looking for a short introductory work on Islamic economics, and without actually directly, so to speak, supporting the viewpoint of any of them, I would say that a book by Omar Chapra, C-H-A-P-R-A, and by Dr. Nejatullah Siddiqui, S-I-D-D-I-Q-I, these are works which provide a suitable introduction to the current orthodoxy, the majority view of how the Islamic economy should function. I may be evading your question a little bit, so please come back and ask me more pointedly if you think so.
And let me just repeat those names for folks who may be looking for a pen to write them down. The first was Omar Chapra, C-H-A-P-R-A, and the second was Dr. Siddiqui, S-I-D-D-I-Q-I. And there are two books. Each of them has a book, sort of an introductory book on Islamic economics. Okay. And for people who would want to do further study, are there websites or are there places where they could get a more extensive bibliography?
Yes. Websites, there are plenty. I think if you just get into your favorite search engine and type, you will get hundreds of references. So there is no shortage on this score, I think.
Of course, then there's always the question of which ones are trustworthy. And so we appreciate your recommending at least two that, although you may not agree with everything they say, are places to start.
Certainly. Okay. I think that would be a good way to go. Let me also take this opportunity to make a slight correction to what I said earlier about the prevalence of Western banking everywhere. Officially, Pakistan has an Islamic, or they said they have Islamized their financial system. However, in talking to friends who travel to Pakistan and go back and forth, they say this has only made a change in name. Basically, the underlying processes that we deal with are very much the same. And the reason why they are the same is the fact that I mentioned earlier, that if you take an investment and you pool it out into many different activities, you will get some average rate of return, unless, of course, there's a catastrophe and everything fails. But you will get some average rate of return. Mm-hmm. They calculate that minimum average rate of return, and they guarantee that. So they say this is a form of profit sharing. Mm-hmm. But it is actually, in that sense, virtually indistinguishable from getting a fixed rate of return in an interest.
Since you have practiced your trade as an economist in the West all your professional life, maybe you'll know the answer to this question. How did Jews and Christians, who, as you pointed out earlier in the program, originally had prohibitions against usury and against the charging of interest and so on, How did Jews and Christians over time get to a place that was so focused on the importance of interest in the economy? And how did those folks reconcile that with their faith?
I think the situation with Judaism is somewhat simpler, because I believe Jews are prohibited from taking usury only from other Jews. They're allowed to take it from Gentiles.
I see.
So over there, the mechanism of banking, so to speak, or of money lending is far simpler, or the reconciliation of the profession would be much simpler. For Christians, of course, the situation created conflict, as I said, all the way through the Reformation. And even thereafter, there was considerable opposition to the idea that you could, that the interest rate was just a market price and you could charge any price for it. So much so that even Adam Smith, who is considered the founder of modern economics, one of the laws he upheld was the usury laws. Hmm. He said that you cannot let the interest rate change. But I think what happened is simply that too many people found it much too convenient to work with an interest-based system. Mm-hmm. And over time, people just eroded their sensibilities on this issue. Mm. And this is how we have come to where we are right now.
I see. Now, what courses do you teach at the university?
Mostly I teach courses in intermediate microeconomics at the undergraduate level. And at the graduate level, I teach courses on economic development.
And do you ever get the occasion to express or talk about the issues we're talking about today in terms of Islamic economy?
Not really. I think I might introduce it more in the future, given the current interest in what is happening in the Muslim world and the desire to understand and to sort of bridge the divide between the West and the Islamic world. But so far, you know, talking about economic development has... There are so many different countries and so many different issues. My time gets completely taken up with all those.
Of course. Well, let's take advantage of the time that we have. What about credit unions? Is that something that would fit with a Muslim understanding of economics? Could a mosque set up a credit union under Islamic rules for its people?
Correct me if I'm wrong in my understanding, but you probably know more about credit unions than I do. But they do describe the return they give you as a dividend, which means that it is based on the profits they make from their entrepreneurial activity.
So you think it might be sharing the risk?
Therefore, insofar as it is sharing the risk, that would be far more acceptable. Huh. What is anathema is the idea that you can simply sit back and say, I have all this money, I'll make all these other people work and guarantee myself a return. Huh. The idea is that everyone must participate.
Interesting.
You have to get into the act yourself.
Interesting. What have been the problems with predominantly majority Islamic countries when suddenly, in addition to the Western banking system that's been going on for a couple hundred years under colonial times, a small group says, but we should be following the Quran. We should set up an Islamic banking system parallel to that. What problems has that caused?
Initially, none at all, because there has always been a small group of people, let me just throw out a number, say 10 to 20% of the population, who are such strong believers that they really are looking for a chance to more actively participate in their faith.
All right.
And as soon as this option was given, these people went and said, okay, we'd really like to practice the system of banking. Hmm. The difficulty arises from the banker's point of view, from the Islamic bank, is in finding reliable people to loan the money to. Mm-hmm. Because you actually have to have oversight over the entrepreneurial activity, which means you need a lot more insight into what is being done with the money. You need to watch what is being done once you've loaned the money because you're sharing the risk all the time. So that makes the actual practice of being an Islamic banker that much more difficult. Mm-hmm. And so far, it has, as I understand it, the successes are limited to short-term loans. Long-term loans become too difficult because you simply have to have much more continual oversight.
Let me encourage callers to ask a question or make a comment. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 will access several local lines, 333-WILL. Anywhere else the program is heard, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Talking with Professor Salim Rashid. Professor, when Muslims want to practice that active faith that you just described in this country? Are there options for Islamic banking here?
Yes, there certainly are. And the one I know of most is called La Riba. Riba, as I said, is the Arabic word for interest, and this is called La Riba to distinguish it from that. And if you have time, maybe I'll just describe, for example, how they assist you in buying a house.
Please.
So what you would do is the house, La Riba, would actually buy the house. And what they would then say is that you will be leasing the house from us. Now, if the purchase price of the house is to be paid to us over, let's say, 10 years, and this is the price, we will take that purchase price without any interest. You can break it up over 10 years. However, while you are paying us back for this house, you are actually living in the house. So you are getting the equivalent of a rental income, which should be due to us. So they then make the monthly payment in such a way that part of that monthly payment is based on the part of the house that belongs to them. Because every time you make a payment, you own a little bit more of the house. So their share keeps going down, and you keep paying rent for your portion of the house until the loan is paid off. So it might look on paper like you are simply getting a fixed-term mortgage. But the principles on which it is calculated are quite different. The idea being that the house initially belongs to the bank, and then you're leasing it from them, you're renting it from them, and then you're paying back through your rental the house. So it's almost like a buy to, what is it called?
Buy to own.
Buy to own.
Or rent to own.
Right, rent to own. Program. Yeah. Exactly, it is that.
We have another caller waiting on line one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. My name's Todd. I'm calling from a cell phone. My question isn't so much about economics, but more about the religion of Islam and Muslim. You use the terms interchangeably, and I was wondering if you could expand a little bit more upon how those are different. And my second question would be, well, more of a comment, is if you could talk a little bit about Ramadan and the fasting that goes along with that. And I'll hang up and listen.
Surely, I'll be glad to. Islam is the name of the religion, and Muslims are the people who follow the faith of Islam. So a Muslim is always a reference to a person, and Islam is a reference to the faith itself. That's the distinction between the two.
And I might just add that in this country, unfortunately, there was a tradition for a while that was rather common of referring to Muslims, people who practice the religion of Islam, as Mohammedans, after the name of the Prophet, peace be upon him, who began the religion. Is that a fair way to say that?
That's right. And
but the correct term is Islam and.
And Muslims.
As Muslim.
That's right.
And then the question was also
about Ramadan itself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Ramadan is a period, a particular month of the lunar calendar. It begins and ends. It begins with the sighting of the new moon and ends with the sighting of the next new moon. And therefore, it's variable anywhere from 28 to 30 days. And during this period, we are required to fast from sunrise to sunset. And during the fasting period, we are not allowed to have any food or water or engage in even those acts such as sexual acts, which are otherwise permitted. We are not allowed or we are not supposed to be angry. We're not supposed to think ill of others. And we are supposed to focus our minds entirely on religion and on the Lord. It's a period when we are to exercise self-restraint and when we are to understand the privation that others who are less fortunate than ourselves are frequently subjected to. Those are, as I understand it, the basic requirements and the, if you like, the social functions of the period of fasting.
And as I understand it, There are some exceptions. Young children, for example, are not required to keep this fast.
Exactly.
It's only after you reach a certain age, is it?
It varies. Most people say by puberty you should start.
Okay.
So you can
early start, teenage
right,
years.
Early teenage years you start, and in fact you find some of the most enthusiastic fasters are those in the early teenage years.
And if one is ill, that's an exception.
And for example, if you bleed, your fast breaks. Mm. I assume that must mean you must bleed seriously, not a pinprick of some sort, but blood will also cancel your fast. Mm. So
would that include menstruation?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. So women are not to fast during their periods of menstruation.
Interesting.
Yes.
Some of our listeners may be curious as to how many Muslims participate in such a rigorous and difficult exercise. Is it a majority? Is it a minority? Fasting, for example, in the Catholic Christian tradition is done much more often, for example, by monks who see that as a specialized way to live a life of prayer. How many Muslims do it?
You're asking me a question to which I can only hazard a guess. but in some ways, I would say that a greater proportion of immigrants actually are more strict in practicing than people are in the home country, for example. So I would guess that probably 50% of the Muslims live abroad practice the fasting or fast during the month of Ramadan. And I'm not quite sure if I'd put that large a figure in the home countries. The part of the reason being that if you're in a country which is predominantly Muslim, somehow the faith and the culture around the faith is always taken for granted, and people never feel that, you know, fasting per se is necessarily valuable. Whereas when you're put in an alien environment as an immigrant, one of two things happen. Either you break away completely or you feel a greater need to reach for that support. So that's pretty much, I would say, how it breaks down.
Mm-hmm. In this country, which began with many Protestant Christians coming here for religious freedom that they were not finding at that time in other places in the world, in Europe, after a couple hundred years, the majority of people in this country would still make a claim to be Christian, maybe only half who claim to be Christian actually participate in a worship service, for example, a couple times a month or more. What in majority Muslim countries would be the participation rate? Who are actively participating in Friday prayers at a mosque, or who are praying five times a day, or doing some of the other things expected of Muslims?
Well, you named two tests over there, which will have very different participation rates.
Ah, okay.
Five times a day, I would guess no more than 10%.
Okay.
If you say how many people come to Friday prayers, the number could easily be in the 60-70%.
I see. All right.
So it just depends on how rigorous and how exacting and how frequent the practice is.
Sure.
That you'll find the number of people who practice going along those lines.
Now, as a well-educated economist functioning at a major research university, how important is your faith to your professional life? Does it have any relation to it?
No, I would say that generally, other than my choice of, say, economic development as a subject I specialize in, where I feel impelled largely by what I would call my social religious concerns to study that issue. Otherwise, I can't point to any more direct way in which it impinges on my work.
Uh-huh.
If I may take a quick minute to mention one point about Islamic banking, which I probably should have done earlier, is that the system of profit sharing, where you are not guaranteed a return, precisely because everyone has to share the risk, the entire system is far more stable because it doesn't go up and down quite as much. And say during the Asian financial crisis that happened in 1997, the Islamic banks weathered the financial crisis far better than the normal banks because somebody is not guaranteed a return regardless of what happens. So whenever something happens, everybody takes an equal bite out of it and suffers or prospers accordingly. And for that reason, there have been famous Western economists like Irving Fisher from Yale in the 1930s who actually proposed that the American banking system be changed to something like a profit-sharing system.
Really? Currently, in the Islamic banking system, is it open to non-Muslims to participate in?
As far as I know, yes.
I think so?
Yes.
Oh.
Certainly.
Are there any Islamic banks in Illinois?
Not that I know of, yet. But in fact, I know that some professors over here, in fact, the late Bill Bryan, was actually trying to get some of the banks over here to open a window that deals with a bank window that deals with these profit sharing activities as part of their regular portfolio because he thought it was a good idea.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, we've reached the end of our time with our guests today, and I want to thank our callers for their good questions and comments. And, of course, our guest in the studio, Professor Salim Rashid, professor of economics here at the University of Illinois. We've been talking about the Islamic understanding of the economy, and want to thank you for taking time during Ramadan to do this.
And thank you so much for this opportunity.
Yes. Let me take just a minute. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the host for the program, and I'm the director of the University YMCA. And there are a couple of events coming up at the Y this week that listeners may want to enjoy. And I use that word very carefully because this coming Tuesday, October 26, singers from the U of I School of Music opera program will be singing selections from the opera Don Giovanni. So if you love those songs of Mozart, you have a chance to hear them totally free at noon at the Y. That's part of our Know Your University series, and lunch is available, or you may bring your own or simply come and listen. That's this next Tuesday at noon, October 26, at the University Y, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. And then coming up on the next Friday, on the Friday Forum noon program at the Y, Kent Redfield will be talking about money and politics in the unregulated state of Illinois. As many people know, the state of Illinois is about last in terms of any regulations and in terms of money involvement in politics. Kent Redfield is from the he's a professor of political science, and we'll be talking from the perspective of the Institute for Legislative Studies. That's coming up Friday at the Y. Also Friday on the Afternoon Magazine at 1 o'clock, Celeste Quinn will be talking with Robert Drynan. That should be a fascinating program. Can God and Caesar coexist? Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has been a thorn in the side of American presidents for decades. He first made his name when he broke the story of the My Lai massacre. But you have to wonder, why did Lieutenant William Kelly actually tell Hersh he'd killed hundreds of Vietnamese civilians?
Because I asked him. Because I found him and asked him.
We'll talk with Seymour Hersh next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Pretty Nails, Milo's Restaurant, and McCandless Photography, located on the lower level, still using a traditional film process to create contemporary portraits.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, clear with a low in the lower 40s and west winds around 5 miles per hour in the evening, shifting to the southeast after midnight. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high in the lower 70s and south winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 40s and east winds around 5 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.